Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Professor Philippe Aguillon from Harvard University. Philippe and I met at the European Economic Association's annual meeting in Glasgow in August 2010, where we spoke about his research on what governments can do to encourage the private sector to do more green innovation.
Mostly the economists working on climate change have mainly looked at, you know, the idea that we should reduce production, you know, technologies that use dirty inputs by means of introducing carbon tax, of cap and trade, etc. But largely disregarded has been the fact that people, firms, not only produce, but they also innovate. They may decide to innovate in technologies that are dirty or technologies that are clean. In technologies, for example, for, you know, that make more use of fossil fuels or technologies that allow you to save on fossil fuels or to use alternative sources of energy. And we know that, to overcome the climate change problem or to mitigate the consequences of climate change, innovation and the diffusion of technologies, of green technologies, will be absolutely important. Having worked on innovations and growth for a while now, I thought it would be very natural to introduce endogenous technical change in model of environment and growth.
Can you give us a general feeling of what we know about public interventions in order to have an impact on innovation as economists? What do we understand by how those methods work?
We know that there are various ways. You can, for example, a carbon tax on its own will tend to direct innovation towards clean technologies. I mean, and in fact, this morning I presented a paper where we use data from the automobile industry, cross-country panel data, which shows that indeed, whenever you have an increase in the price of fuel or an increase in the fuel tax, that leads firms to direct innovation activities towards clean. But there are other instruments which, besides a carbon tax, which are direct subsidies to clean R&D or to the diffusion of clean technologies. And in fact, the optimal portfolio of policies is not just the carbon tax, but a mixture between the carbon tax and these other policies, so that not all the burden is on the carbon tax. And of course, factoring in technical change leads you to think deeper about how to conceive of this optimal portfolio of policies.
Can you explain a little bit about how you see these interventions operating, how they work in terms of encouraging firms to invest more in clean innovation as opposed to dirty innovation?
They encourage more because if you put a carbon tax, you reduce the profits that would be earned by using fuel inputs. But we know that the profits are what rewards innovations. So if you reduce profits from dirty activities, you also reduce the reward that would accrue to an innovator that innovates in dirty technologies. And therefore, that in turn will tilt his incentives towards innovating in clean innovations, you see. That's how carbon tax. But of course, the direct subsidy to clean innovation will also have the effect of shifting R&D effort towards clean innovation. The question is, to which extent those are substitute or complements? And of course, the advantage of the subsidy is that you deal directly with the incentive and you don't put too much pressure on current consumers. But the advantage of the carbon tax is that the carbon tax is non-targeted in a sense that you don't say, you don't target R&D subsidies to a particular activity. And so very often we are worried about, industrial policies whereby you would pick winners, for example. So it's true that the R&D subsidy targeted might have more of a flavor of industrial policy. But on the other hand, just using the carbon tax also has its downsides.
I'd like to come back to the issue of industrial policy in a moment, but I'd like to talk a little bit about the data you put up. You put up some interesting data on patents and patent citations as a kind of indicator of R&D changes over time. Can you give a flavor of the story you told there?
So we had a data set. It's a world statistical data about patents around the world, but it's patent. Those all concern firms that have patented in Europe. So what happened, you have the European Patent Office. For any patent at the European Patent Office, they look also if the same thing has been patented elsewhere. So they have this way a record of patents, not only in Europe, but also they can find out if those innovations that have been patented at the EPO, the European Patent Office, have also been patented at the Japanese Patent Office or at the US Patent Office. And also the data set we have is very interesting because we know who has patented. So we know the history of patenting. So we know, for example, if those who innovate dirty today are those who have innovated dirty more in the past. And in fact, what we established in the presentation, in the paper I presented this morning, is that there is what we call path dependence in the direction of technical progress. If you have innovated dirty a lot in the past, you tend to innovate dirty more today. You tend to continue to do things you were good at. There is no reason a priori why it should be the case. You could have argued that there are decreasing returns. You could have argued that because I have innovated a lot dirty in the past, I run into decreasing returns and I rather start innovating clean. But in fact, that's not what happens. If you're a good cook and a bad dancer, and you've innovated in cookery, cuisine in the past, well, you prefer to innovate in cuisine now than start innovating in dancing. You see what I mean? And that's very much the way it works. And it has big implications, this path dependence, because typically firms in our economies have innovated a lot in dirty technologies in the past. And therefore, if you have no intervention from the state, they will keep on innovating dirty today, which means it will be much, much, much harder over time to make them produce and innovate in clean technologies. You see what I mean? So that's it's a very important path dependence because it implies that there is urgency to intervene. If you don't intervene today, firms will keep innovating dirty. So the technological gap between dirty and clean technologies will increase, and it will be much more costly to restore the balance in the future, to make firms produce and innovate clean in the future.
So the intervention is in a way saying, give up your cookery because it's damaging everybody, and we're going to shift you over to dancing. We're going
exactly.
to give you incentive to shift
exactly.
over.
Exactly.
In the data, do you see differences across countries in terms of the balance between clean and dirty innovation?
We know that, for example, in Japan or in Denmark, in some of these kind of they have done more in terms of clean innovations in general, not just in the automobile industry. US has done very little, for example. France, not too bad. China, not too bad, actually. China is taking seriously clean innovation. Sometimes people believe that China is not playing the game at all of the green economy. And in fact, they are. They are getting into green innovation. So you see, but particularly striking is the fact that the U.S. has been very, very much out of it.
But you have seen an increase over time, generally across the world, in clean innovation. What is this a result of? Do you see this as a result of previous interventions that governments have made? Changes in fuel prices, for example?
I think changes in fuel prices already had a bit of the effect of inducing it. And I think people now foresee that there might be, that, you know, it will be more and more important to go towards green, clean cars, etc. You know, I think it's been a bit because the increase in the price of oil, the fear that we might not have access to oil so easy, partly as a result of carbon tax in some countries. But what's interesting is that in spite of a lack of public policy in this domain, I mean, in this private firms are anticipating things will happen. It's very interesting if you look at the private markets, you can see that there is interest for green technologies from the private sector. If you look at the venture capital, there is action in the clean sector, actually.
There's also, of course, a lot of interest in governments in encouraging green technology, and you've mentioned some ways they might do it. But there seems to be almost a focus much more these days on industrial policy, government thinking we can pick winners in green technology and we can push it. Do you still go along with the traditional economist view that industrial policy is a very dangerous route to go?
Well, it's true. I think it was good to be cautious and say pick winners is not a good thing. I mean, it's not a good thing because the government might not know who the winner is because, you know, it opens the door to more corruption and lobbying. So it has a lot of downsides. And I think it was good that economists in the past 20 years have pointed to the downsides of, you know, the top-down pick winner policy. But does it mean that you should have no sectoral policy? And I believe not, because if you believe in particular, and climate is a case in point, we know that under laissez-faire, if you don't intervene, firms will innovate dirty. So you have to step in and say, we'll induce you to innovate clean. Now, it doesn't mean that you pick one winner, but it means that you will encourage firms that want to pursue production and innovation in clean technologies. But the idea would be to say, whoever enters and does that, I could subsidize or I could help. So it will be an open subsidy. It will not be for one firm only. So it will be competition friendly. It might even spur competition because maybe firms would have differentiated each other from each other a lot. And by focusing on some sectors, you push firms to go in the same sector and therefore compete more closely in that sector. So the idea that sectoral policy would always be the opposite of competition policy, I think that is going too far. One thing is to pick one winner firm, but one thing is to say I have a sectoral policy which is competition friendly and which is open to everyone who goes into the sector. A good argument for that is that there are externalities like path dependence externality that are not internalized. Another argument for industrial policy is also that, you know, capital, physical and human capital, that does not always relocate on its own because you have your credit constraints, because you have, and that's another reason why government may want to step in. But again, it should do it in a way which is competition friendly.
What should be the role, do you think, of public investment in green R&D? We know that public sector investment in science is very important for encouraging private sector to pick it up and use it and for growth. What should be the role of this particular area of green innovation, do you think?
No, I think there is a synergy between public and private intervention. I think the public intervention can come in, but together with private investment. So I very much see intervention as, for example, like in co-financing arrangements, for example. You could very well imagine, you know, we co-finance, you see. That's good, the co-financing, because if it turns out that the project is bad, private sector withdraws, and then the public sector knows it has to withdraw as well. You see, that's one way also to make sure that if you pick the wrong winner, you don't pick it for too long. You see what I mean? So I think there are ways to do it which would involve partnership between public and private. And my feeling is that once at some point, because of path dependence, once clean technologies will have become very sufficiently advanced, path dependence will play then in reverse. It will guarantee that first private sector firms under laissez-faire will keep innovating clean. So the idea is that the government steps in to redirect technical change towards clean, but after a while, there is no need for the government to stay because the market on its own, thanks to path dependence, but it's a path dependence that will make clean firms innovate clean in the future. And that's why you can see that, you know, this view of the world is really a kind of third wave view, a bit where you have partnership between public and private sector.
Philip, you spoke in your talk about the whole area of the microeconometrics of climate change being almost virgin territory. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah, I mean, so far what people have done is that they have used calibration to calibrate macro models. So there is the Nordhaus model. We saw this morning elaborations on the Nordhaus model. And what people do usually is they calibrate at a macro level. They say we want, you know, to map the share of capital and labor that we observe in practice. We want to map with the average growth rate that we observe in practice. We want to map with, how concentration of CO2 translates in temperature increase at a macro level. So we do macro calibrations of models, okay, which is already a very good first step. But I think there are important parameters, like, for example, the elasticity of substitution between clean and dirty inputs, or the productivity of clean and dirty innovation or clean and dirty imitation of technology. Those parameters can only be estimated, should be estimated, not just calibrated, should be estimated using microeconometric analysis. I think that's the way to go. So what we tried to do this morning was to already estimate, test for the path dependence assumption using macro data. But I think in a very similar vein, we should use this kind of data to estimate these parameters, and then we can recalibrate. You see what I mean? But I think it's very important now to replace calibration, or to at least to add to calibration exercise, microeconometric analysis. And so we put IO and microeconomics and microeconometrics into climate change and growth. I think that's the kind of big agenda for the future.
So final question, where does your own research fit into this? Where do you see your development of this research
program?
But
I think it's very much in line with what I've tried to do. I mean, I don't know if people will tell me if I have brought anything to economics, but I think one thing I tried to bring to economics was to put IO into growth. They say, industrial organization is at the heart of the growth process. And you should understand market structure, the organization of firms. All these things are important to understand the growth process. And I try to do the same here with climate. I mean, you need to go into the details of, you know, how firms operate, how they mix clean and dirty, how they, what kind of innovation technology they have access to. You need to go into those details to get back into growth. And that it's part of this agenda of putting industrial organization in growth.
Philippe Aguillon, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.